This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to The Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Matt Sleppen to the show. He is founder and managing partner at Terra Search Partners and founder and former executive director of the Multifamily Housing Institute. He is governor of the Urban Land Institute, otherwise known as ULI, and host of the podcast Leading Voices with the ULI. Matt, welcome. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thank you, Jason.
Good. Give us a sense of geography. Where are you located?
Good question. I'm in San Francisco. I am looking out my office window at Chinatown, up the hill, Chinatown to Nob Hill.
Yeah, good stuff. Let me actually correct you on your location. You're in the Socialist Republic of San Francisco.
I've heard that before, yeah. And it may be true.
It is true. Oh, good stuff. You know, you've got a tremendous background and resume. Give us a little insight as to just sort of the broad brushstrokes of the real estate market, the economy. And when we talk about real estate, feel free to segment between different product types and geography, however you want. But I just wanted to kind of start with that broad stroke, if you would, and you know, get a feel from you as to whether you're bullish or bearish. And, you know, we've got a new administration. A lot of things have been changing. Just take it wherever you want.
Sure. Holy cow, that's a big question.
It's a big question. Big compound question.
Let me answer it as best I can and understand that I come from the perspective of someone who's somewhat well-read. So I kind of watch trends. I understand what's going on in the world. The particular thing that I do and my company does is we're recruiters exclusively in the real estate world. So we find senior executives to join real estate teams. And so we track the world, at least through work, through what we hear from candidates, what we hear from clients.
You have a really interesting viewpoint in doing that job, because if real estate companies are optimistic and they're expanding and they're hiring, and if the talent market is scarce and they really need recruiters and they can't do it directly, so they need to hire your firm, that's a sign, right? That's a big sign.
Absolutely is a sign. And, you know, when the cycle went down in 2008, 2009, we felt it extraordinarily painfully. So it was really bad. The way I look at it is we're at a stable, normalized part of the business cycle right now, even though the recovery from the Great Recession is very, very long in the tooth. It feels like we're going to keep going for a while. And there's various parts of the real estate business that feel kind of normalized to a good place, particularly the apartment industry where we spend a lot of our time.
Tell me about that apartment industry comment, if you would, because multifamily housing, and I own apartments myself and a lot of single family homes. I love single family for the most part, but the multifamily side of the world is just so, I mean, the cap rates have just plummeted and the competition and the prices have just gone through the roof. I mean, it's like, and then, you know, there's been a ton of construction too. And you got to ask yourself, has that cycle tipped? Have we now overbuilt apartments yet, or do we still need them, or kind of what's your view of that?
Yeah. So let's take both the short view and the long view. So here's the very long view. And it's interesting because I started my career 35, 40 years ago in the apartment business. So that's the sector of the real estate industry that I've known the longest and the deepest. And even 20 years ago, apartments generally were not part of the real estate investment landscape, not part of the institutional grade real estate investment landscape. And apartments had to fight to get into the portfolios of the pension fund advisors, for example.
Clarify that time frame for us, if you would. Like, what year are you talking about?
So probably until the SNL crisis.
Okay, so in the late 80s, SNL early crisis. 90s?
Yeah, know, late Charles 80s, Keaton, early 90s, okay. Even mid-90s, you know, there were the apartment REITs were a de minimis sector, So it wasn't really an institutionalized business that the REITs accomplished. And then the second thing is that the large pension fund advisors, which were where institutional real estate happened, for them, they wanted trophy office buildings. They didn't invest in industrial. They invested in retail, particularly trophy retail. They didn't invest in apartments. They only then began investing in apartments, you know, back around the time of the S&L crisis. Mm-hmm. And it was an emerging market for them, and apartments had to fight to have credibility as an institutional-style investment
class. And you mentioned the S&L crisis as a kind of a landmark, if you will. But, I mean, it didn't have anything to do with all the famous characters like Charles Keating that we saw during that crisis, did it?
Right.
Or was there a connection there at all?
No. Not the way that you may be thinking.
Right.
No, it's just that, you know, apartments were way overbuilt in the S&L crisis.
Right.
So that's a different story.
Yeah.
But apartments weren't really viewed back then as an institutional grade investment business.
Yeah.
And what did change really from two or three different perspectives is, one, the apartment REITs became, you know, accumulators of assets in that space, and they became very sophisticated owners and operators of kind of larger scale institutional properties. And then the second thing is, alongside or maybe pulled along from the REITs as well, is that the big money managers started investing in apartments. And also on the debt side, the same thing happened. And what the industry began realizing is that apartments specifically were a low beta way to invest. And the trends in the apartment industry as an investment class versus the office industry or the retail industry is it was a lower beta, pretty strong, safe, and stable investment.
Mm-hmm. So less risky. And certainly now, it's really interesting to hear these historical comments in light of what's going on now with the retail apocalypse,
right?
The diminishing need for office space as, you know, Fortune 1000 companies tell people to work out of the house, and there's all this offshoring, and, you know, some of that may change a little bit, but I doubt we're going to see any huge recovery in the office or retail markets. I mean, that just does not seem like it's in the cards, but maybe you disagree with me. I don't know.
Well, retail different than office.
Yeah,
but
well, sure.
You know,
but I'm just saying both of them seem like they're in trouble, if you'd ask me. But
in some ways, but in contrast, just to make the point to apartments, is that apartments are a safer, more stable investment class. It may be overbuilt at the moment in certain markets, and we'll get to this in a minute, but the home ownership rate having gone down and the apartment renter rate going up and all the demographics in the industry have also, alongside the institutionalization of the business, have caused that to be an asset class. It just makes a ton of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I love housing. When it comes to real estate, I'm a fan of housing, whether it be apartments, single family homes, or mobile home parks. Those are my three favorite asset classes, because as long as the population is stable or increasing, you're in pretty good shape in the housing world, like fundamentally. In the other sectors, there's just too much change, I think. So I agree with you on the low beta angle. Yeah.
Absolutely. People have to live somewhere, and that's going to continue to happen. But then your earlier question is, you know, where are we in the cycle? Are apartments overbuilt? Rents have tapered off or gone down in some markets. Does that mean a long-term trend in that direction? And my guess, and I'm not an economist, so I'm a recruiter, but I see a lot of things. And my guess is that the secular change towards both people wanting to live in more dense urban areas and maybe not having to own everything, I think those are long-term trends, and those trends benefit the apartment industry in the long term. So again, over the long while, I would think it's still a really good place to be. And I think the companies that do the business are becoming more and more professional, institutional, and long-term.
Yeah, no question about it. Okay, so when I ask you that big, giant compound question at the beginning, did you have any more thoughts on that in terms of like which markets are overbuilt on the apartment side, sort of more about what the future holds? Any more thoughts there?
Not specifically, and I'm not the right person to comment on that. I do have opinions. I'll just give a couple of anecdotal examples. I do travel a lot for business and for pleasure. And I'm in San Francisco, and San Francisco has been one of the hottest markets for apartments, and rent growth has been phenomenal, and it has tapered down over the past maybe year or so, and maybe we're temporarily overbuilt. So that's comment one. Comment two is there's a lot of growth in terms of development in different places around the country, but in places like San Francisco specifically, building is really, really tough, and that skyrockets cost, and demand goes high, and there's a lot of ripple issues with NIMBYism and limits to growth. So I'm a pretty free market person.
Right, right. And NIMBYism, of course, is not in my backyard, which is what all the, I always like to tell this or ask this riddle, you know, what do you call a developer? Someone who wants to build a house at the beach or in the woods. What do you call an environmentalist? Someone who already owns a house at the beach or in the woods.
This could be
that's
true.
That's the NIMBY syndrome for sure.
And,
yeah.
And we have YIMBYs now because, you know, there's young people who say, wait a minute, housing's not affordable. This doesn't make sense. And we like dense urban spaces. Mm-hmm. Let's, yes, in my backyard.
Oh, so interesting. Yeah.
There's a countervailing trend that in some ways I love. But the point I was going to get to a minute ago is I do travel, and with ULI, I was at a meeting a couple of weeks ago in Nashville. And we toured the city, which has had just a tremendous amount of development over the past cycle. What was an interesting thing I had no idea of is that until, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but call it 15 years ago, you couldn't build an apartment in downtown Nashville. It's illegal to live there. It's probably an exaggeration. But the nighttime population was de minimis in that city, and you couldn't build. And then they changed the rules because it became a 24-hour city, and maybe they've built 10,000 units in town or more. Now it's an incredibly lively, vibrant, 24-hour place to be. And young people, you know, want to be there. They may move to the suburbs as they grow up and have kids. But, you know, for now, apartment living is a wonderful thing. So that's another driver. And Nashville's an example. That's all over the country.
That's for sure. So curious to see what you think. Yeah, I don't know if you've really thought much about this, but so maybe kind of out in left field. But what do you think about the rise of the autonomous vehicle and the self-driving cars just changing the kind of demand equation for high-priced, high-density real estate? And I'm predicting the resurgence of the suburbs. You know, the suburbs have some nice advantages. I mean, understand that personally, I love walking-based communities. I love the, you know, walk out your door and go to the coffee shop and all that kind of stuff. Absolutely my favorite type of land use. So I'm with the YIMBYs on that. What are your thoughts on that? And maybe ULI's thoughts in general.
Can't speak for ULI. I can speak for myself as a city dweller. We actually talk about this a lot. And I walk to work. So when I look up through past Chinatown to Nob Hill, that's my walk to work. Mm-hmm. So there's coffee there, and it's a 15-minute walk, and it's really fascinating. And we're down to one car, which we generally don't drive during the week because we take Uber and Lyft all the time. And that the convenience of that beats both the wear and tear in the car plus trying to park and getting robbed when you're in your car. But self-driving cars will make that even more so. Right. So Uber and Lyft is stage one, and then self-driving cars be stage two. And I think it helps both the suburbs and the cities. So, you know, the densification happens more when cars are commodity from that perspective, and you may not have to have the car in your garage, or you may not own a car because you just call it and it shows up. But equally, it's helpful to the suburbs. So just a funny story from the search world is we made a job offer to someone who had a pretty long commute just this past week. And probably a 45-minute commute both ways, and that gets old. And part of the job offer package that the client made to this candidate was option A will pay you X, option B will pay you X minus a plug number that would allow you to take Uber or Lyft back and forth to work every single day, and we'll pay for it. Hmm. And basically, you have a limousine on demand service. Mm-hmm. And then you don't have to think. You don't have to worry about it. You can sit in the back seat and do a whole lot of work while you're driving.
Sure, sure. If the driver will shut up.
That's a good question. I love talking to those people.
Well, I do too, but they kind of don't stop. You know, I'm always talkative with the drivers, and, you know, I always like to hear their perspective, but, you know, sometimes they just prattle on and on. So when that car is completely autonomous and there's no driver, that's really a game changer. And it's just on demand, and people don't even need to own a car. And that's where it's going.
Yep, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And you know, what does that mean? Because these are whole different subjects. But, you know, what does that mean from the both Uber and Lyft drivers, but taxi drivers? What's it mean for truck drivers?
Yeah.
There's a whole
class. Yeah. Transportation is one of the biggest industries on planet Earth, if not the biggest. So it's a big deal. And I mean, a lot of my, interestingly, very, very libertarian friends are mm-hmm. actually thinking that we have to have some sort of living wage that we're going to, you know, governments around the world will just have to just give people. And maybe they'll be able to afford it because maybe technology will change the game so much. Maybe certain things will be very deflationary. Not everything, certainly, but some things will be technology-based things. It's really interesting. I mean, it's a fascinating time to be alive, but it's really hard to understand how this is all going to play out. I guess they've probably always thought that, but there's so many variables nowadays, right?
Purely more now than at any time in the history of the earth. And if you just take the subject that you did, and we don't want to veer into politics here, but it's easy to do it, which is that you could take a lot of the less skilled workers and a lot of those jobs, and if they just disappear, this is not something that current president or any other president can wave a wand and solve, because they're inevitable trends. And what do you do with inevitable trends of big parts of the workforce going away? What you don't want is people sitting around being angry. And so there has to be societal solutions to that kind of retooling of the country. And again, way off the real estate trail, but those are huge issues. And of course, as good citizens, we think about them.
Yeah, they certainly are. So tell us about Urban Land Institute a little bit more, what they do, and like, what's the vibe nowadays? And, you know, how much has it changed over the years about development? I mean, you talked about the YIMBY and the NIMBY, of course, but just, you know, kind of what are some of the issues that are being tackled and discussed?
And I can give a general overview of that. Of course, I'm not a spokesperson for ULI, so I have a good sense of what's happening there and what happens within the industry. And gosh, it's changed just a huge amount over the years. So first of all, the Urban Land Institute is an international organization dealing with the effective use of land planning, basically, around the world, although the largest part of the organization, of course, is in the United States. I think we have like 40,000 members worldwide. So this is a global organization, and it really is the place to go. I think think tank's not the right word, but it's the place to go, the convener across the board in the real estate and land use business, certainly in the U.S., but also globally. And that's where minds come together. So I think it has a tremendous opportunity and position within the industry. And if you look back at planning, and I'm not a planner, but if you look back at, you know, what was normal in the industry 20, 30 years ago, it was greenfield development. And greenfield development done well are the suburbs we have right now. And another word for them might be sprawl. So you'd said earlier, suburbs are wonderful. And I agree. I just moved into the city from, you know, 20 years in the suburbs, which I loved. But the dynamic of development now has changed. And because we're changing in a world of sea rise, we're changing in a world of transportation, changing in a world of you don't want gridlock, you'd rather be dense. So the urbanization is just an inevitable trend that makes a lot of sense. And ULI and its members and the thinking of our industry in totality has really evolved with that and changed. So that in some ways, where if you went to a ULI meeting 20, 30 years ago, again, I'm making this up, I was there, but I'm making up the comment, is maybe that you would look at the winning plan of the year might have been a suburban town with sprawl around cul-de-sacs that just had the best practices in that era. And those best practices are generally gone now. One of the podcasts I did a couple weeks ago and was just released this week is with Andre Dewani, one of the co-founders of the Congress of New Urbanism. That is more of what is current and happening now, as is the response of the industry to, you know, more development in urban areas.
Mm-hmm. I just, again, keep wondering if that's going to change, if that's there's going to be a shift in that. We shifted toward the suburbs for decades, you know, the post-World War II world, the Levittown world, that, you know, I remember a long time ago, the Irvine Company being, with what they did in Southern California, being thought of as a like the winning development plan when they developed Woodbridge. And you know, that was so famous. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, urban planners came from all around the world to study that in places, especially like Singapore. And now, you know, that would not be considered a winning plan. Too many stoplights, too much getting in your car. And so that has definitely shifted, but I just keep thinking it's going to shift back the other way.
You know, I think there's going to be a balance.
Yeah, I think the pendulum is always swinging, right?
Yeah, it's probably always swinging. I'm a balanced person, so I think there's a middle ground to almost anything. It drives my wife crazy because there shouldn't be black and white answers. But one of the answers
are,
is
are you
that,
a
you
Libra?
Know, both works. I am. How did you know?
See, I'm a Libra too. That's how I knew. Yep. Libra, the best sign of balance. Good stuff. Is there anything else you want to just tell our listeners, or, you know, anything you think they should know? Maybe something I haven't asked you?
Yeah, well, I think what one of the purposes of the call today may be, you know, the podcast that I'm hosting. And so I'll tell you a little bit about that, which is, and you mentioned at the beginning, it's called Leading Voices with ULI. And in the podcast series, we have brought together, I do interviews, there are 30 to 45 minute interviews with leaders throughout the real estate world who have wildly different experiences, from the most successful sales broker in New York City who runs the local office for CBRE to a community developer in Cincinnati who runs a nonprofit that's really saved the downtown and the adjacent neighborhoods, to the president of Tulane who helped redevelop both Tulane and the city of New Orleans post-Katrina, who sat there through Katrina and then came out and reacted to it in my words, a Captain Sully way, to, I mentioned Andre Dewani, and all kinds of others, leaders of companies, a guy named Toby Bizzuto, who now runs his father's development company.
Right, right. Yeah, that's really interesting to have all those perspectives. I mean, share with us some of their views and some of the things you're gleaning from them, if you would.
So I've done about 20 of these, but there's just dozens of stories, and they're all different. So it's less their views are really interesting, so we could talk about that, you know, but it's what are their pathways has been half of the story. What do they do? How do they contribute to the built environment? And it's in such a plethora of different ways. People do so many different things, and when you hear what they do, you go, holy cow, this person's making a difference, is making a living, is doing great work in that niche versus another niche, right? So that's, to me, fascinating. And they're all impacting how we live. That's the theme and the diversity of what we're talking about. And then the stories of how people get into this and how they follow their path to become, let's say, the CEO of CBRE in New York, really different than Toby Bizzuto taking over the business that his dad and some partners founded. So did you grow up in this business? And then was there some inevitability to this happening? Were you trained through your life? The woman in New York who runs CBRE had never heard of the word real estate till she was 36. Swear to God.
Well, that's impossible.
I mean, well, she'd heard the word real estate, never knew of it as a career. That's
right,
a better way to state it. And then on a Vaporetto in Venice, someone says, you should try commercial real estate. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right. Now, she was a highly accomplished person, and then whammo, kills it. And so I'd never heard a story of someone that late in their career coming into our business and then hitting it as hard as she has.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. Something that you talked about, I watched a little video on your website about recruiting and in the real estate industry. And one of the things that we constantly struggle with, it, you know, our business is pretty problem-free, except the hardest part, I would say, is property management. And one of the things, interesting things I heard when you were being interviewed on that video was about how property managers generally, when you talk about property management, I mean, there's all sorts of sectors and sizes and everything, right? But I'm talking mostly about the residential side of property management. But generally, those property managers are not college educated, and they started young in that business and then just got promoted up. So tell us about that. Do you want to expand on that thought for a moment? That was kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one to me as well. So, and it gets back to some of the comments about the institutionalization and professionalization of that business. So you have two conflicting trends. So trend number one is the people on site at properties are kind of the less skilled side or the more blue collar side of the industry. And a lot of the people start on site as leasing people while they're maybe even college or graduate high school and then don't get to college, or maybe go through a couple of years of college while they're at a property, and they start leasing and making a living and then start getting promoted within that property.
Right.
And either graduate college or don't quite graduate college and then start a career, and they start going up the food chain. And property management, particularly in the apartment business, is a relatively hierarchical business where you're leading the troops. So you get up one level and you get up another level, and all of a sudden you're running multiple sites and multiple managers, and you're making a good living, and it's fun, and it's a very professional business. And so that's trend number one.
How does that affect clients? Like, what do you sort of think about that? Do you think that they get inferior service, that the industry hasn't developed as well as it should, maybe, because these people are not as educated, and, you know?
So yes and no. So it's not an issue in and of itself, but it comes at an issue if you think of the bottom coming up, if you also think of the top coming down. So I have a picture of stalactites and stalagmites or something, right? Mm-hmm. And where do the twain meet?
Yeah.
And so the other issue, and then I'll answer your question. The other issue is these companies have become more sophisticated. So you have very, very large management companies or REITs that own, you know, boatload of units all over the country. They become incredibly professional. They rely heavily on technology and training. And that's where the business has gone. The leaders that they need, if you're thinking about them from a national standpoint, I have 80,000 units of apartments, and you know the average cost of these things maybe $400,000 or $500,000. This is a real serious business. Then the person you want at the top of those companies tends to be an MBA type, and so therein lies the clash between the top down and the bottom up, because the people coming up from the bottom learning the business are kind of limited in their depth and perspective and broad business knowledge because they grew up on site, become very well trained. They're really good customer service people. Think of hotels, have very much the same business.
They got a lot of frontline experience.
Yeah, and they're great. Customer service could be wonderful. They could be trained to do these jobs extremely well. The question is, who can run those companies? And traditionally, the people running those companies have come up yet one more step from the bottom. And so they're running those businesses, and that's where the talent gap lies, because in those more sophisticated, larger institutional companies, they're looking for business leaders who bring a sophistication, institutional knowledge, sophistication of how to run a very complex, multi-pronged, multi-site, national, sometimes even a global business. And those people certainly need college education. You know, more often they need an MBA or some further diversification to understand the context in which they're operating. And that doesn't happen from the bottoms up, didn't quite make it through college.
Yeah, really interesting. Okay, good. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining us. Give out your website.
Yeah, it's www.terrasearchpartners.com.
Matt, it was great talking to you today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check out HartmanMedia.com for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.